All right, we got through 11 of these slides. What were we talking about? What was the exception to Mendelian genetics that we already covered in the previous slide?
Incomplete
dominance, right. And why is it called incomplete dominance? How is it distinguished from complete dominance?
It's a mix of both colors.
Well, color doesn't have to be even involved, but that was the example.
Yeah.
And it's not actually a mix of the colors. It's just that if an individual has only one of the dominant allele, then the effect of that dominant trait won't be full. Whereas if a person is homozygous dominant, they'll have a double dose of that dominant trait. They'll fully be dominant in their trait. And not all genes work that way. Like the, you know, for the purple flower versus white flower pea plants, one dominant allele was enough to make the flower fully purple. So it doesn't always matter. That's the difference, though. Incomplete dominance requires two dominant alleles for the phenotype to be fully dominant. All right, that was one exception to Mendelian genetics. Now we'll continue and talk about some others, starting with slide 12. And this deals, as you see, with human blood, and so let me just give you some background about this to make sense of what the example is. There are dozens of different human blood groups, but almost everyone knows about only two of them because they're so much more important clinically than the others, since disobeying them and transfusing into the wrong person can kill you when it comes to two of the blood groups. And those two blood groups that most people know, even though there's many more, are the ABO group and the RH group. So usually when we talk about someone's blood type, we're really just giving you the results of two totally unrelated groups. Like, for instance, O negative means that person is O in the ABO blood group, and also negative in the RH group, and the RH group has nothing at all to do with the ABO blood group. It's just, we lump them together because both of them can cause serious damage if you give the wrong blood to someone. Anyway, we're not at all talking about the RH group here, so positive and negative doesn't matter here. What we care about is the ABO blood group. And this has to do with antigens and antibodies. Antigens are particles of some type. Antibody, sometimes antigens are proteins, sometimes they're not. Just depends. But antibodies are always proteins. And specifically, they are proteins that operate for immunity because an antibody, because of its particular shape, is able to recognize the shape of some particular antigen. And usually the antigen is a foreign particle. This is exactly how vaccines work, right? You get a COVID vaccination, you are spurring your body into producing antibodies that recognize an antigen that's part of the COVID virus. And if you already have that on hand before you actually get the real virus, then you'll have an army of proteins on hand to destroy it before you can get the disease. So antibodies are proteins that recognize something that is not part of that individual, a foreign particle, which we call an antigen. Now when it comes to ABO blood group, first of all, there is whole blood, which is an entire tissue. Whole blood contains blood cells, five different types of white blood cells plus red blood cells, but almost all the cells are red blood cells. And then plasma, which is the liquid component of whole blood that's outside of the cells. Antibodies are in the plasma of the person's blood. Antigens are on the surface of the red blood cells, if they are present. And so here in this cartoon version, you have triangular, circular antigens on the surface of these red blood cells, or erythrocytes. A type A person has on his or her red blood cells A-type antigens. That's what's represented by the triangles. That same person's plasma would not have anti-A antibodies. Otherwise, that person's plasma would attack that same person's own blood cells. Right? So the plasma of a type A person has anti-B antigens, which will recognize B antigens as foreign blood. And conversely, a type B person has B antigens on the surface of the red blood cells, has no anti-B antibodies, but does have anti-A antibodies in the plasma to recognize A as foreign blood. Well, if a person is AB, type AB, then notice both types of antigens are expressed on the surface of the red blood cells. And therefore, either kind of antibody would get you in trouble, right? So an AB person doesn't have either anti-A antibodies or anti-B antibodies, because either one of those would attack that person's own blood cells. And then the other possibility is a type O person, in which neither type of antigen is present on the surface of the red blood cells. And therefore, the plasma of the type O person has both anti-A antibodies and anti-B antibodies. So, in other words, it will recognize any of the other three as foreigners. The anti-A antibodies will recognize A antigens of a type A or a type AB. The anti-B antibodies will recognize the B antigens of a type B or a type AB person. But there's nothing to recognize on a type O cell, and therefore that person, that those antibodies don't attack that own person's cells. All right, that's how the ABO group works. It is used here as an example of actually two different, independent, not related to each other, exceptions to Mendelian genetics. So this is really two examples in one slide. The first reason that this is an exception to Mendelian genetics is because it features multiple alleles. So multiple alleles is a category of exception. Remember that the first exception we looked at was incomplete dominance, which you could tell just by the name has to be an exception, right? Why is that? Why do you know just from the name that incomplete dominance is an exception to Mendelian genetics? Right. What are the two requirements for something to be Mendelian? Completely dominant. Yes, you have to have exactly two alleles for the gene in question, and one of those alleles has to be completely dominant over the other. So incomplete dominance tells you that's not Mendelian, that violates one of those requirements. Well, so does multiple alleles as a name. Multiple here does not mean two or more, it means three or more. So when that's true, obviously it's not true that there's exactly two, which there has to be for it to be Mendelian. You see here that for the ABO blood group, there's three different alleles corresponding to A, B, and O. Now, they all involve an I here. The I stands for immunoglobulin. which is the type of protein that antibodies are. That's why it's in the symbol. But uppercase I with an A superscript really is a type A allele. Right? These are genotypes, haploid genotypes. But a diploid person is going to have two of those, right? So notice that in the specific types that are shown down here, the genotypes have both symbols. Two symbols, I mean. Well, there's two different ways that a person can be type A. Either as a homozygous person, in other words, both of his alleles are the type A allele. Obviously, that's going to be a type A person. But also, A is dominant over O. So you could be heterozygous as in having one A and one O allele. That's going to make you fully type A, simply because A is completely dominant over O. And B is also completely dominant over O in this multiple allele scheme. So there's two ways you could be type B. Homozygously, BB, or heterozygously, BO. In either case, phenotypically, you're the same. Those are indistinguishable because of complete dominance. So it's either one of these genotypes corresponds to a completely type B person. The second reason that this is an exception to Mendelian genetics is for a category named codominance. And it's important not to confuse codominance with incomplete dominance. With codominance, the two codominant alleles don't dominate over each other in any way. Co means share, right? So the two codominant alleles, if they are both present in the same individual, will both be fully expressed as a phenotype. And what that means in this particular blood group example is that a person with both A and B allele, a type AB person, will be just as much a type A person as a only type A person, but at the same time will be just as much a type B person as a only type B person. So neither A, it's not true that A is somehow obscuring B, it's also not true that B is somehow obscuring A. That's unlike complete dominance, right? Where if you had the one purple allele, that obscures any white allele that you have in the pea flower color example. Here, A-ness and B-ness are both being fully expressed at the same time because they are co-dominant. Each of them individually dominates over O, but neither dominates over the other. So that's why you have both antigens expressed. Because of complete dominance of either A or B over O, though, that means that the only way you can be type O is to be homozygous for O. Just like the only way you can be a white-flowered pea plant is to be homozygous recessive. All right. Now, when it comes to transfusion, by the way, it's you have to be careful about memorizing universal donor and universal recipient, which are often used, because it depends on what is being transfused. Usually, what they're talking about when they say universal donor or universal recipient is the situation in which only red blood cells get transfused, not whole blood. Did you ever learn what universal donors and universal recipients are in any any of these? Oh, type O, for instance, is often called the universal donor. But you have to be really careful with that, because you would never want to give whole blood from an O person to anything but an O person. If you spin the whole blood down with a centrifuge so that you separate the blood cells themselves from the plasma, and you give only the red blood cells from an O person to someone else, no problem at all. That's why they're called universal donor of red blood cells. And that's because the cells don't have any antigens. So it doesn't matter what kind of antibodies the recipient has, it has nothing to attack. But if you give the whole blood, which includes the plasma of a type O, you're going to be giving both anti-A and anti-B antibodies to a person that has at least one of those two antigens in their blood. And it's going to attack that blood. So don't think of those universal tags as being for whole blood. Those are for red blood cells only. Anyway, that's two separate exceptions to Mendelian genetics. And that brings us to 13 for another exception. These rats illustrate an exception with a name that's often mispronounced. It's called epistasis. Now, looking at this picture, how many characteristics are we looking at? What are they? Well, why did you say two?
Because I see B, B, C, C.
Okay, that's good thinking. Yeah, and look at the genotypes. There are two different types of letters here in the genotypes. And what does each individual letter of a genotype represent? Like a single B, for instance. What does that represent?
An allele.
An allele, exactly. In other words, a version of a gene. Uppercase B and lowercase B are different alleles for the same gene. But what you recognized is that we have a B here and a C. Therefore, there must be two genes involved. Was that your reasoning? That's right. There are two genes involved. But unlike all the examples up to now in which a gene corresponded to a characteristic, there's only one characteristic here that we're looking at. It's just coat color. That's it. There are three traits, right? White, brown, and black. But there's only one characteristic, despite the fact that there are two genes involved. And that's why it makes it epistasis. This is different, in the incomplete dominance situation, the first exception we looked at last time, that was also a situation where we had one characteristic and three traits. But that was because of incomplete dominance. It involved only one gene, right? It's just that because of incomplete dominance, the heterozygous individual was different phenotypically from the homozygous dominant individual, so you had three traits. Well, that's not what's happening here. This is a totally different reason. Epistasis is a type of gene interaction. So that phrase, interaction, tells you that you must be dealing with more than one gene. And specifically, in epistasis, what's happening is that the product of one gene affects somehow the expression of another gene. Now let's talk about that phrase, the product of a gene. What does that mean? What is the product of a gene? No, product means a real material. What is the product of a gene? Ultimate product. A protein, right. We're here, when I say gene, I'm talking about a protein-coding gene, which almost all are, right? So the direct product of any gene is the RNA. But for a protein-coding gene, the ultimate product is whatever protein the gene indirectly codes for. Meaning that if that gene is expressed, it's going to go through transcription, and then the mRNA is going to go through translation to build some particular protein that the gene corresponds to. That's the gene product. In the case of epistasis, that protein, whatever it is, influences whether or not a completely different gene gets transcribed. For instance, we earlier talked about transcription factors, right? Which are required to be present at the promoter of a gene before the RNA polymerase can come and hit and join that promoter to turn that gene on. Well, transcription factors don't just pop into existence. They are the gene product of some other gene. So that explains what we see here. The B gene is a gene whose product is a pigment. And there are two alleles for that gene. Unfortunately, B stands for both black and brown, but it really stands for black. That's the dominant color. So uppercase B specifically stands for the fact that that allele will be transcribed and translated into black pigment. Lowercase b will make brown pigment. All right? But, of course, that B gene is only going to produce that pigment if it gets transcribed. And it's only going to be transcribed if the transcription factor is connected to its promoter. The transcription factor is the protein that's produced because of the C gene, which stands for coloration. All right, so the C gene is able, the product of the C gene is able to turn on the B gene. That's why it's gene interaction. And notice that there's also two alleles for C. Uppercase and lowercase. The dominant allele for C is the only one that produces a protein that actually turns on the B gene. A recessive version of C will not do that, and therefore the B gene, whatever allele it is, will not get turned on. Does that make sense? Look at the white rats here. All four of these has two lowercase c's, which means none of these four has the ability to make the necessary protein that will then join to the promoter and turn on the B gene. So it doesn't matter what the B genotype is for any of these, because that gene is going to stay off since it doesn't have the help of the protein produced by the C gene in this case. All right? And therefore, no pigment gets deposited in the fur and it remains white. For all of the other cases, there's at least one uppercase C because of complete dominance of uppercase C over lowercase C, as long as you have one uppercase C, that will be enough to make the protein that will turn on the B gene. And so as long as there's one uppercase C, then there will be pigment deposited, and then you look at the B genotype to determine what that pigment's color is going to be. Black, if there's at least one uppercase B, and brown if there's two lowercase c's. Okay? That is epistasis. Any questions about it? Yeah.
So the red eyes and the white eyes, whatever, like, how does that work?
Right. There's no pigment deposited into the iris of the eyes, which is what gives the eyes their eye color. The redness is just a reflection of the light from the retina, because there's a lot of blood vessels behind it. And you see that redness in non-albinos when you use a flash, right? Before the flash, everyone's adjusted to lower light level, so their irises are dilated. And then the flash comes along with faster than the iris is able to close down. And so there's a lot of light going into the eye. It gets reflected back and it looks red. Okay. Ignore slide 14 for a moment, because I don't have a picture for this next exception. It's kind of slide 13 and a half in a sense. This next exception is called pleiotropy. And pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene controls multiple characteristics. And a lot of textbooks use as an example of this the gene that codes for human hemoglobin, which we've already studied for other reasons in other chapters. But you remember this example? There's a gene for human hemoglobin protein that, if it's the wild type version, will make the correctly shaped hemoglobin, and that will do a good job at carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide. But there's also the mutant version, which, if it is present, will end up creating misshapen hemoglobin, which not only doesn't carry oxygen and carbon dioxide very well, but also causes them to come together and misshape the red blood cells, leading to sickle cell disease, which is bad news. It's you don't want to have sickle cell disease. So you might be thinking, why does this persist? Natural selection operates in a way that should make that disappear over generations, right? Because if it's an allele that is so deleterious, meaning so bad for you, that it should decrease in frequency each generation, because those people don't have nearly as much chance of passing it on, since they don't survive as well as ones that are normal. That's just how natural selection works. And that is true if it were the case that it were only bad for you, that allele. But this is an interesting case that this is kind of a 182 topic, but it's called heterozygote advantage. What we have in the situation of hemoglobin is that if a person is diploid, right? So it has two alleles for hemoglobin. If a person is completely normal, meaning both the alleles are wild type, then obviously that person is not going to have sickle cell disease, right? If a person has both alleles, the mutant form, then that person is going to have sickle cell disease, which is bad. But if a person is a heterozygote, that means having one normal and one abnormal allele, that single normal hemoglobin allele that the heterozygote has is enough to keep the blood working, to make hemoglobin that's normal enough not to have sickle cell disease. So it keeps that person from having sickle cell disease, be a carrier of it, but won't have it his or herself. The The one version that's mutant, though, in combination with the one that's normal, actually is a better situation than being fully normal in one respect. And that is that a heterozygous individual will have a greater resistance to malaria than a completely normal person. So they don't have the disease, which keeps them alive and reproducing, but they also are better off when it comes to avoiding malaria than a completely normal person. And this is why that mutant allele persists in the population, because the heterozygotes, which are each carrying one of those alleles, have it better off than anyone else, and they pass that recessive allele on. It's only when two recessive alleles get together in one child from two heterozygous individuals that it actually leads to sickle cell disease. But this is also why you see the prevalence of that allele in populations that live in areas of the world where malaria kills millions of people, including several countries in Africa. But anyway, that heterozygote advantage, that this whole hemoglobin example, is an example of pleiotropy, because you only have one gene you're talking about. It's that one hemoglobin gene. But it is simultaneously determining more than one characteristic. It determines the shape of the hemoglobin and also whether or not you're resistant to malaria. Two different characteristics. All right, now we can get to 14. And this category of exception is called polygenic inheritance. Now, what does polygenic mean? Just look at the word.
More than several genes.
Right. Right. Poly means many. And so polygenic means involving multiple genes. And by multiple, more than two. Poly, you know, just like you have a disaccharide is not a polysaccharide, because two isn't really many yet. Poly means many. Anyway, for polygenic inheritance, what you typically have, if you do have polygenic inheritance, is a characteristic for which there is a continuum of traits. A continuum is like a spectrum between two extremes, but there's fine gradations of everything in between. Well, what example we're using here in this slide is human skin color. And, well, first of all, we all the time use the phrases white person and black person when there is no such thing as either one of those. No human is white. Even an albino. No person is black. Skin color is a combination of redness and brownness. Redness from the blood and brownness from melanin, the pigment that's deposited in the keratinocytes, skin cells that carry that pigment. And the overall shade of the skin is due to how much of that melanin pigment, how many of those molecules get deposited in those cells. Well, that itself, how much melanin gets deposited, is determined by not just one gene. If it were, then we would have basically two shades of people. Just like pea flowers are either purple or white, nothing in between. But instead, we have very light, very dark, and everything in between, which is what these boxes are kind of showing. And the reason that there are so many values between the extremes on this continuum is that multiple genes are involved. Now, I don't know exactly how many genes are involved, but this picture pretends that it's 6, just for illustration. Each gene in one of these zygote boxes is represented by a circle. And there's 2 alleles. If the circle isn't filled, that allele doesn't lead to any pigment being deposited. If it's the dark allele, then there will be melanin deposited. But the overall amount of melanin is due to multiple different, in this case, 6 different genes determining the overall amount of melanin. So you don't just have 2, you have many shades. Now notice that polygenic inheritance is kind of like a convergence. Converge means to come together. Because you have multiple genes converging all onto one characteristic, in this case skin color. But when you compare that to pleiotropy is like a divergence, right? Because you have one gene that is simultaneously affecting multiple characteristics, as opposed to multiple genes affecting one characteristic, like in polygenic inheritance. That brings us to 15. Now, these 2 plants obviously have different color flowers. Well, obviously, if you're not colorblind. But it's a pretty stark difference in color, right? And so, almost anyone randomly sampled, randomly surveyed, or I should say anyone who's at all studied genetics, would probably guess that these 2 individuals have different alleles for the flower coloration gene, which is perfectly reasonable, especially based on what we've learned about pea plants. But that actually is not what's happening here. These individuals are genetically identical. Now, obviously, they are phenotypically different. How can genetically identical individuals be phenotypically different? How can they have different traits when their DNA is the same?
Based on where they're born or where they grow up, is that environmental?
Exactly. This slide makes the important point that although, of course, there is a genetic component to phenotype, whatever phenotype you're talking about, there is also an environmental component. This is often said in one famous phrase, nature versus nurture. Nature refers to the specific DNA that you get, so that's the genetic component. Nurture refers to what happens to you during your life. That's the environmental component. So, for instance, 2 genetically identical plants can be planted into soils that differ in their pH. I'm not sure that that's exactly what the difference is here, but that can affect plants. You see this in people's yards. I mean, some cacti will be reddish, others will be only green. They're exactly the same species, but the soil is different. And also, just think about it in terms of humans. If you have genetically identical humans, which happens by accident, starts out as an intended one person, one zygote, that accidentally splits, and therefore it's two genetically identical cells, but each one is then treated as an individual zygote that goes on to develop into two multicellular humans that are genetically identical. Those are identical twins. So only one sperm and only one egg were involved originally. Well, if they are separated at birth, don't even know that each other exists, and they spend 80 years at totally different parts of the world, they will resemble each other after those 80 years, but they're no longer going to be identical, right? Because the environment is what your body is made out of. The cells of your body come from the materials in the environment, the food you eat and other things that enter your body other ways. So, depending on the characteristic, environmental influence can be actually pretty profound. It can be even more important than the genetic component. But there is, for any given characteristic, there is both a genetic and an environmental component. Okay, 16. You see here some family trees. They're probably what most people would call them. In genetics, they are called pedigrees. And it's not so big a deal nowadays as it used to be, but an important part of genetics was pedigree analysis. The reason it's not so much a big deal nowadays is because it's pretty easy nowadays to just sample someone's DNA without hurting them in any way. So you can directly look at people's DNA to figure out their genetic makeup. But before that was possible, pedigree analysis could get you at least partly there. The reason that we need to go through with this is basically an exercise in logic, trying to figure out things logically. The reason we have to do this for humans is because, for various reasons, we can't subject humans to test crosses, for instance. Right? For one thing, it's illegal and unethical to breed someone for the sake of figuring out their genotype. But also, even if it weren't, it would just be a pain in the ass. You have to wait a long time, right, before you get the next generation. But obviously, that's not going to happen for humans. So if you want to figure out, if you can't look directly at the DNA, which we couldn't until recently, then pedigree analysis can sometimes figure it out for you. It's really just a matter of looking at ancestors and their traits and figuring things out based on knowledge of dominance and recessivity. For instance, if you are the child of two parents, neither of which has a recessive trait, but you have the recessive trait, and you know they're your parents, what does that mean about your parents? Both of them have to have it. The only way that would be possible genetically is if both of your parents are heterozygous. That's exactly what happened, by the way, from the F1 to the F2 of the purple-white pea plant. Right? When you, all of the F1s had what kind of genotype? What was the genotype of every F1 individual in the flower color example for Mendelian genetics?
Heterozygous?
Yes, they were all heterozygous, so they were all upper lower P. Right? This individual does not have white flowers. When you cross that with another F1, which is what we did to produce the F2, this other individual doesn't have white flowers. When you do a Punnett square, though, for those two, you get three of them that have at least one upper P and therefore are purple flowered, but one of them has two lower peas and it has white flowers. So this is exactly what I just described. This child has a recessive trait. Neither of its parents had it. The only way that's possible if they're both heterozygous, because the only way to be recessive is to be homozygous recessive. The only way you can be homozygous recessive is if you get a recessive allele from each of your two parents. And if they don't have the recessive trait, then that means they must have each only one recessive and the other dominant. In other words, they're both heterozygous. And that kind of logic goes into looking at the ancestors. The squares are males, the circles are females. A filled-in symbol means that that person has the trait. An empty one means that it doesn't. And you just use the logic of recessive and dominant traits to figure out what genotypes could be without genetically testing them. Well, we wouldn't bother to do that nowadays to a great extent, because we can simply sample the DNA directly. But we couldn't do that. This illustrates a couple possible prenatal tests that can be conducted to test for possible genetic disorders that would make it impossible for a baby to survive. For instance, amniocentesis on the left. These both do the same thing. These two tests both test the genetics, the genetic composition of the fetus before birth, but they do it at different times. Amniocentesis is actually the later of the two. Notice that this fetus is more developed than this one. This is not long after the embryo stage, early fetus. This one's a later fetus. And in a later fetus, the fetus is surrounded by a bunch of amniotic fluid, which is basically swimming in, moving around in that amniotic fluid. And just like you in a swimming pool, you're going to lose cells to that water in the pool. Well, if you sample the amniotic fluid with a needle, you don't damage the fetus, but you can get cells from that fetus that have been shed into the amniotic fluid, and then you can conduct genetic analysis and determine whether there's something that could be preventing it from living, for instance. You do the same thing with chorionic villus sampling. This is just earlier, when there is a much more when there's a thicker placenta, which is a pretty interesting organ, because the placenta is not just the mother's, it's not just the fetus's, it's simultaneously an organ owned by both. It's where exchange takes place. But if you use a suction tube and just take a little bit of the tissue from the placenta, that will allow you to harvest fetal cells that way, and the results are the same. You look at the genetics of the individual. Ah, 18 and 19 are the end of the chapter, and this is the typical thing that you see in a lot of these shows. It's just a summary. So we've covered all of this. Notice pleiotropy is listed here, even though there was no corresponding slide, but as I said, sickle cell disease is an example of that. So that means we're done with the chapter. And I have plenty of time to start the next chapter, but my previous section decided they wanted me to just quit here and do the other chapter next week. So that's what I'll do.